Good day. You're listening to Animal Voices, your animal rights radio show here on CIUT 89.5 FM and worldwide on www.ciut.fm. I'm your host today, Rob Moore. Lauren is off for the week, but she'll be back next week to talk about the dairy industry, I believe. And thanks to Lamia for starting off the show with some joyful rebellion. She's our DJ in tech, as always. Today is the invasion of the vegan snatchers, and I say that with tongue firmly in cheek. We'll be speaking with a number of activists on the best way to go about converting the people in your life to veganism. And veganism, for those who don't know, is a philosophy wherein you don't need to exploit or ingest or commodify animals to live. In fact, it's actually harmful to you and the world if you do. It's really going back to the basics of vegan activism today, because you convince two people to become vegan, and they convince four, and they convince eight, and so on and so on, and it just snowballs. And that's called, boys and girls, the snowball effect. So today's show is actually on how to be better snowballs, because you know what? Somebody has to save the planet, and it might as well be us, right? But change is slow, so it's best to be as effective as you can be. And to help us out with this will be Bruce Friedrich, Director of Vegan Outreach for the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, Joe Stepaniak, well-known author and educator, Lee Hall, Legal Director for Friends of Animals, Gary Francione, professional rabble-rouser, author, and, oh yeah, he's also the Professor of Law at Rutgers University School of Law. And finally, from the UK, a superstar activist, author, and vegan mom, Mary Brady, and her 9-year-old son, Seamus. To learn more about our guests and to hear past shows, do visit our website at www.animalvoices.ca. Just a couple of news items to start off the show. This Saturday, May 21st, is the 9th annual Global Boycott Procter & Gamble Day, and there's a link on the front page of our site to info on why you should boycott Procter & Gamble, the vivisection they're still involved with, and which products to avoid, that kind of thing. Again, that's on the front page of our site, www.animalvoices.ca. Because, you know, there's no reason to test cosmetics on animals, you know. There really isn't. And also from the National Post, corrections facilities will begin offering inmates a vegan meal option in the near future after suits by two inmates were launched with the BC Human Rights Tribunal. Keith Madak, who served 2 years in BC jails, and Robert Anderson, currently incarcerated in Kamloops, BC, began the action after being denied accommodation by prison staff for a vegan diet. While at the Fraser Regional Correctional Center in Maple Ridge, B.C. for a week in 2002, Mr. Madak refused to eat because staff would not accommodate his vegan needs. The prison offered a vegetarian option, but it included eggs and cheese, which Madak said are against his religion. He tried to refuse the trays of food at mealtimes, but was told he would be put in segregation if he didn't eat. So he accepted the trays and gave the food away to other inmates. So I think that's great news for prisoners, you know, to at least not have to deal with that sort of oppression.
It's incredible.
Yeah, I think it's awesome.
Most prisoners that I have heard about don't get anything.
I know, they don't get any choices whatsoever.
No, it's not about corrections.
So
it's
oppression. I think that's a great advance for human rights indeed.
Mm-hmm.
We're actually going to go to a music break because we're going to have Bruce on in just a few short minutes. You're listening to Animal Voices on CIUT. We're back talking about Invasion of the Vegan Snatchers, now with Bruce Friedrich, who is the Director of Vegan Outreach for People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, and is quite the mover and shaker in the animal advocacy movement, at least according to those who saw him streaking in front of Buckingham Palace with GoVeg.com painted on his back. He placed 5th on Details Magazine's October 2003 list of the 50 most influential people under 38, and we're delighted that he could be with us today. Bruce, thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for the invitation.
Great. Now, you talk to people every day about going vegan, but what about your friends and acquaintances? How do you try to introduce them into veganism without beating them over the head every time you see them?
Well, it really varies, I suppose, on how close of friends and acquaintances they are. People oftentimes agonize over their mother or their father who just refuses to go vegan for such a long time, and I would counsel people to continue to bring it up somewhat gently, but oftentimes it's just, you know, the whole idea that a prophet is least listened to in their hometown. That's even more true, I think, in families. So probably the appropriate response is to let people come at their own pace and then to pledge to convert somebody else and forget about your father for a day or two. But The same sort of thing may be true with close friends and acquaintances. Oftentimes with people who you see enough, your example is going to be the best method of bringing them along. Well, not letting yourself off the hook, we do want to have these conversations with people and explain why it's important to us. And certainly we should never, under any circumstances, say that it's not that big a deal or it's a personal decision or I don't want to talk about it. If somebody asks us, I guess it's morally incumbent upon us to be the animal's voice and to have the conversation.
So is there a specific story that you have about converting or trying to convert someone to veganism that you learned from and that you think our listeners could learn from?
Well, I mean, I hear these sorts of stories all the time of people who have worked very hard on a close relative or worked very hard on a husband-wife partner, and then what it took was that the partner or close relative needed to hear it from another venue. So we do these Helping Animals 101 conferences. We've got one coming up in Toronto. And oftentimes people are successful in getting relatives to come along to the conference to find out, you know, what's this wacky animal rights thing that Angela is involved in or Bruce is involved in or Rob is involved in, and they come to the conference. And as a result of the conference, the family member goes vegan or goes vegetarian or becomes an animal rights activist. And it's not that we're saying anything that the relative hadn't been saying for such a long time. It's just oftentimes difficult to hear it from your relative who you've grown up with. You've seen them in their at their best and at their worst. And mm-hmm. You know, sort of like Eddie Lama says in the movie The Witness, where he talks about trying to convert his family, and his family says, "Eddie, you know, we're not going to take this from you. You're a criminal." It just people who have been with us for our entire lives, oftentimes it's hard to hear it from us.
It can be difficult, and you know, this is really for a lot of the young activists who perhaps are new to veganism and not quite sure. I mean, they're really excited about veganism and they want to, you know, grab everyone they meet and say, "Listen to what I learned." For those people, would you suggest something like giving a copy of Meet Your Meat to everybody you know, or to simply, as you said, live by example and let the dialogue come to you?
Well, one thing that a lot of people at PETA have started doing with quite a bit of success and that we suggest that people do, oftentimes we are our own worst enemy in that we come on so strong. And it's reasonable and rational to come on that strong. What's happening to animals on factory farms and in slaughterhouses is morally reprehensible. It would be felony-level animal cruelty if dogs or cats were mutilated without pain relief or had their throats slit open while they were fully conscious. And it's a reasonable and appropriate response to that to scream at everybody who continues to eat meat, but it's not an effective response. They don't see things in the same way that we do. So oftentimes, especially for new vegans, new animal rights activists, our impulse is to immediately tell everybody about it, which is reasonable, but oftentimes to tell them about it in a way that's tough for them to hear it. Something we've started doing is asking friends and loved ones who are particularly resistant or even really resistant at all, as a birthday gift or an anniversary gift or a Christmas gift, to read a book or read an essay or watch a video and then discuss it with us. And we've been doing this for a couple of years, and we've had countless success stories. It's very, very difficult for your father or mother to say to you, "No, I'm not going to get you the one gift you've asked me to get you."
Mm-hmm.
And to do that in a very loving way, to say something like, you know, "This is a part of my heart. This is something that's absolutely crucial to who I am now. And it saddens me that we can't share that," to say that to somebody who's not willing to even talk about it, as so many people are.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, what I would like to...
Sorry, I'm going to actually interrupt you there. I just want to ask one quick question before we go. In terms of your dialogue with the people every day through PETA, do you have a consistent dialogue that is generally successful when you talk about veganism, be it from like a point of animal abuse or health,
mm-hmm.
or is it always subjective depending on the person?
Well, my favorite T-shirt says, "Ask me why I'm vegan," and I wear it everywhere that I can wear a T-shirt. So I have this conversation all the time and everywhere that I go. And yeah, my challenge to people when I'm having this kind of spur-of-the-moment conversation, I always carry literature. I always give somebody a free vegetarian starter kit. And my basic argument is, look, these animals are being treated in ways that would warrant felony cruelty to animals charges if dogs or cats were treated so horribly. I don't want to pay other people to do something that I can't do myself. There's not integrity in paying other people to slit animals' throats open in slaughterhouses when not only can I not do it myself, I don't even want to watch it happening. So So the challenge is to ask people why they eat meat, bring that back to people and say, why do you eat meat, and explore that. And the most powerful argument, I think, is the issue of basic integrity. If you're not willing to do it yourself, you shouldn't be paying other people to do it for you.
That's exactly what I've used for years. But I really like that, having pamphlets on you to give to people when they ask the question. Because sometimes it's kind of an argumentative question, right? And they're not really open to dialogue. So instead of actually trying to start the dialogue with someone like that, you can just hand them a pamphlet.
And we will send people free, unlimited vegetarian starter kits if they want to do that. We've also got these little cards that are perfect for your wallet. They have our 888 Veg Food Line, and anybody who calls that number, we also send them Meet Your Meat. So
great.
Nice little conversation thing, too. You can give people the card and say, call this number, and they'll send you a free DVD called Meet Your Meat that's narrated by Alec Baldwin.
And they can find all that at goveg.com.
Or by calling 888-VEG-FOOD.
Bruce, thanks a lot for being with us.
You bet. Thank you, Rob.
Thanks. That was Bruce Friedrich, Director of Vegan Outreach for People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. He's often referred to as Bruce Poppins because he's got such an optimistic outlook on life. We're now going to speak with Joe Stepaniak, an educator, counselor, mediator, and author or co-author of several books, including Raising Vegan Children, Compassionate Living for Healing, Wholeness, and Harmony, Being Vegan, Vegan Deli, Wholesome Ethnic Fast Food, and the very popular The Ultimate Uncheese Cookbook. She was also on the show last year helping our listeners negotiate veg-non-veg relationships, and we're happy she's here today. Joe, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rob. Good to be here.
Thank you. As you know, we're addressing the basics of vegan activism, not overzealously trying to convert the whole world vegan, but just talking to the individual people in our lives. So I'll start by asking if you have any stories that stick out in your mind of how you learned to best approach this.
I only have one great success story, and that was with my husband, and that was 27 years ago. And that worked because I backed off, and he came to the decision on his own. And what I have found is that people who are interested, sincerely interested in changing their diet and changing their lifestyle are the ones who are going to be the most receptive and open to information. And those who aren't really interested, it's like banging on a locked door. It's such a waste of energy.
Right.
Although I've gotten wonderful feedback from people that I don't personally know who told me that many of my books had helped them enormously make the decision. For instance, they may have come across the vegan source book at a friend's home or at the library or in a bookstore and picked it up, and they were thinking about becoming vegetarian and decided after seeing the book they were going to go vegan instead.
And what about, those argumentative people who, as you say, it's like banging against a wall trying to talk to them. And, they might have some kind of jackass comment at some big dinner gathering or something for you about being vegan. Do you have a quick comeback? Do you suggest people, start a dialogue, or do you just try to let it go and, walk away?
I think it depends on the situation, and I think it depends on the person. If it's a celebration event and there are a lot of non-vegetarians there, chances are I'm not going to say anything, and I'll just let it roll off and be an example of the compassion that I try to preach.
Mm-hmm.
It just depends. It depends on the circumstance. I might talk to that person later and let them know that my commitment to being vegan is extremely important to me, and to let them know why. Sometimes that face-to-face, direct honesty can jolt somebody a whole lot more than having a snappy or sarcastic comeback.
And it's a lot less stressful, too.
Oh, absolutely.
A lot of people, say to me, oh, I wish I had said this and I wish I had said that. So you're constantly playing these scenes over in your head, whereas I guess, as you say, if you let them come to you, then it's a much more open and comfortable environment to speak in.
Absolutely. I think that all of us have been approached by people who were fanatical about whatever it is that they believe in. It could be something religious or something political, and they believe with all of their heart that they are absolutely right, and that if you don't follow what they do, what they believe, that there are going to be serious repercussions, either for you personally or for others or for in an afterlife, and they feel that their cause is quite noble, as we all believe about our cause. But we also know how we're turned off by people who are that aggressive and that persistent in pushing their viewpoint on us when we're not interested. So I don't like to be that kind of person to somebody else.
Right, yeah. The next question I have, I think, is, well, it's difficult for me. There was a reporter here in Toronto recently that took a meat-free for a week challenge to see if she could live as a vegan. And at the end of the week, despite a few shortfalls, she said she'd actually have no problem being vegan, except that she liked to socialize too much. And, you know, eat out with friends and not worry about what restaurant to eat at, that kind of thing. What advice would you give her?
I would probably tell her that if she was committed to veganism, she could find something to eat virtually anywhere, and that she doesn't have to compromise her beliefs and convictions to socialize. I certainly don't, and I have remained vegan without any difficulty. There are many tips that you can use to get by. For instance, eating before you go out, if you know you're going to be going somewhere where the options are going to be very limited. And also getting used to knowing that you just have to ask a few questions. You don't have to grill people to the end of the earth, and you don't have to draw attention to yourself in order to get something that is appropriate.
And what about someone who, and I'm asking your advice on several questions because I think you're a great advice giver. What about someone in this, this is coming from someone who lives in a big city. How do you get someone who's living in a large, urban, fast-paced environment to slow down and look at how their choices are affecting the world around them, let alone to consider veganism?
Again, I think it's important to consider the individual and whether or not this is something that is important to that person. If living in a way that is compatible with the environment and supportive of the environment and not damaging to themselves, to the earth, to other people, to the animals, then you've got somebody who's right to have a conversation. But most people don't want to be talked at. It's important for us to find out where somebody is coming from and hear them and hear what they're interested in, so we can formulate an appropriate dialogue with them. If we go into a conversation solely to get our point across without hearing what the other person needs or wants, we're going to both come away empty. So again, I suggest taking a clear and honest assessment of who we're talking with, and make it talking with rather than talking at or talking to.
And Joe, just to give an example to people, if we were just walking together on the street and I asked you, why are you vegan, what do you usually say?
I try to keep things short and simple, and I generally tell people for every reason you can imagine.
And then I guess that leads to more questions.
That often leads to more questions, and sometimes it doesn't. If somebody doesn't want to get into a conversation and talk about things they're uncomfortable with, they might just drop it at that point. But often it does open up areas where people will say, so it's about compassion, or you don't believe in killing, or it's for your health, or it's for environmental reasons. And I'll say yes to all of those, and then they might ask more in-depth questions that get into more detail. But I like to keep it short and simple and not preach at people. And most people have an idea, well, you must be for this reason or that reason. So I just confirm that, yep, you're right, it's for all of those reasons.
Hmm. Yeah, I guess that's a good gauge to decide if a dialogue is possible with those people.
Yes. Depending on how they respond, we can continue a discussion, and if they want to drop it, I let them drop it.
Did you find throughout your life that you had to sort of reconcile that excitement about activism you had and wanting to, you know, convert the world vegan to finally, as you said, lead by example and be comfortable with that and let people come to you? Was that difficult for you, or did you go through that transition?
I think it's a maturation process.
Yeah.
It was for me, because when I was younger, I was just exhilarated, filled with passion. And not that I'm not now, but it has softened. I have a more mature attitude about it and an appreciation of other points of view. Even though I may disagree with people, I do know that they are entitled to their beliefs and their way of life, even though I would like them to change. I know that you can't force change. And that has taken me quite a while to understand that anger and pushing people doesn't get the results we truly want.
Joe, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Rob.
I really enjoy having your message of compassion because it's peaceful. I think, you know, activists, we need to find that peace a lot in our everyday lives. So I want to thank you again for being on the show and being part of Animal Voices again.
Thank you so much.
Great. Speak to you soon.
Okay.
That was Joe Stepaniak, educator, counselor, mediator, and author of several books. You can find out more about her when you visit our site, animalvoices.ca. We're going to speak now with Lee Hall, who is the legal director for Friends of Animals and a member of the adjunct faculty of law at Rutgers University in Newark, New Jersey. Lee has taught both immigration law and animal law at the school where animal rights first entered the North American Law School curriculum. And as many of you know, that is courtesy of one Gary Francione, who we'll have on in just a few minutes. Lee, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ron. How are you?
Great. I'm so happy that you can join us today.
Thank you.
In addition to all your great work with Friends of Animals, which I think is a fantastic organization, and all your teaching, you've been doing talks in churches. Could you tell us about that and what kind of success you've had?
Yes. These have been churches at the Unitarian Universalist Congregation, and this has been in New Jersey. And when this first started out several years ago, when I was first invited, they said that they had already invited somebody 2 years before to talk about animal rights, and it had not gone over well. Apparently, the person that spoke said so much about biting on flesh and blood and innards and all that the congregation just couldn't take it. And so I was told with some trepidation that they were permitting the same organizer who 2 years earlier got that person to try again. So I was a bit concerned about, at first, you know, how this would go over, because they already had a distinctly negative view. But the Unitarian Universalist Church, you know, has been active in many very good things, many good social justice movements. They've been working on the homelessness issue and stopping prejudice against gays and so forth. So I told them that I would be speaking on bringing social justice to the table. Well, they were very happy about that. And since then, I've been invited back many times, and I'm going to be invited. I'm going to speak in July at one of the congregations, so it's gone really well. In fact, one of the ministers at one of the New Jersey congregations said to me after one of the, I guess we'd call it sermon, said I'd like to change my diet. So when a minister says that, of course, it's a very exciting feeling because that person can touch so many people. So the other thing is, just in the past few years, one of the concerns that people have had, of course, has been whether people involved in animal rights have something to do with, you know, direct action. Mm-hmm. And so I said straight off the bat, yes, the life of a vegetarian is direct action for environmental justice. It's direct action for global food security, and that's for world peace. And it is direct action for the liberation of other animals. And when these thoughts came together, I think they realized that these ideas are interconnected, or perhaps they thought about that before. Mm-hmm. But in any case, the message worked out very well, and we started with environmental justice, and they were, I suppose, largely unaware that even the Pentagon had come out with a report that said, because of the potentially dire consequences, the risk of abrupt climate change, although uncertain, should be elevated beyond a scientific debate to a U.S. national security concern. Obviously, that will be true for Canada and for any other country. So they then realized, if we're talking about national security, which side is the vegetarian on?
Hmm.
If within a couple of decades there could be catastrophic shortages of water and energy, and that could lead to widespread war, that we were going to have to prepare for U.S. and Canada being virtual fortresses, which is what this report
So you did talk to these congregations more about those kinds of philosophies as opposed to the animal abuse in slaughterhouses and factory farms.
Well, I already knew that had not gone over well.
Right, right.
With this group.
Yeah. Mm.
And so I began with this, and then I explained that these ideas were interrelated, beginning at the nexus with the methane from the cattle. methane from cattle as well as oil and gas as 21 times the warming potential of carbon dioxide. So then they started putting together the animal agriculture with this idea of human rights and this idea of environmental justice. And I then explained, you know, we hear a lot now about if an animal were a non-human in a lifeboat with you, what would you do? Save the animal or save yourself, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I explained that all life on Earth is now clinging to a lifeboat. It's not a case that we don't face the lifeboat situation every day, that that's only an emergency situation, that we shouldn't think about, we shouldn't worry about it morally. We should,
mm-hmm.
because we are in a lifeboat every day. The animals are in there with us. We put them there. And if we don't think about what we're doing now, we're in effect throwing countless animals off the global lifeboat by what we're doing today.
Right. We have to take responsibility and accountability for every choice we make. How do you think those elements that you talked about in the congregation, how do you think those could be applied in everyday conversation with individuals if you're introducing veganism to somebody?
Well, I think it's important to keep this issue positive. One of the things that I think could be extrapolated from the congregation to talking to just about anyone, for example, John Robbins, you know, has a lot of facts on what good you could do if you become a pure vegetarian. For example, you save an acre of trees per year. Well, if you tell somebody that, obviously that leaves other animals their natural habitat, and it's a key to preserving the Earth's atmosphere. Then you're telling people that by their direct action they do have real power. I think people want to know that. People tend to think, well, what can I do? I'm only one person. Whatever I do, I mean, I may as well be a flexitarian, right? I mean, what does it really matter? Who am I? But when you think of it in terms of what you really can do, and that each person you're talking to has the potential to talk to other people. And so this, you know, sort of works in a chain, as it certainly did in this example of talking to a church. My chances were particularly good of reaching a lot of people. But I think that really what you're doing, if you're standing in front of a group of people or you're talking to one person, you're doing the same thing, because you are changing one mind at a time. Each person is using their individual mind. And at any time you get to the point where somebody's seriously thinking and asking you, how do I do this? You have just started a revolution.
That's a really great message of empowerment, of individual empowerment. I think that's really powerful.
And I want to say that I've noticed that your forum and your show does put an emphasis on environmental awareness. And these are things we really have to think about, too. You know, the animal advocacy movement has tended to see animal advocacy in sort of a box, right, as a distinct issue. And really it's time to go beyond that. And now, of course, if we're not facing an emergency scenario, we still want to have the same powerful message. It shouldn't take a catastrophic change impending upon us possibly in 20 years, should it? I mean, this is something that we should be able to talk about no matter whether this is an environmental emergency or not. We should still be able to talk about our moral, our ethical position. But at this point, I certainly think that given the world population, and given what scientists are telling us, even scientists that are doing studies for the World Bank or Tony Blair, the Pentagon, it's time to wake up. You know, it's time to wake people up. And I think putting all these issues together will make us realize that on a day-to-day basis, I mean, this, we didn't get to this position overnight. It's been the things that we do day-to-day that put our world in the position it's in.
That's excellent. That's why I titled this Invasion of the Vegan Snatchers. It's kind of the opposite of the body snatchers, in that you wake people up to what's going on. I love it. Thank you, Lee, for being on the show.
Thank you, Rob.
Take care.
All right.
We were speaking with Lee Hall, Legal Director for Friends of Animals. For more information about her and other guests, you can log on at www.animalvoices.ca. Next up is Gary Francione. He is the Professor of Law at Rutgers University School of Law, author of such books as Introduction to Animal Rights, Your Child or the Dog, Animals, Property, and the Law, and Rain Without Thunder, The Ideology of the Animal Rights Movement. If he were a superhero, I think he'd be Batman, for reasons that it might come apparent as you listen to him. He's also developed some really interesting, exciting coursework at Rutgers that he'll tell us about in the coming weeks. And here's a short pre-record that I did with him last week. Here's what he had to say when I asked him how he introduces people to veganism.
Okay, Gary. Well, I know you probably had a lot of success turning people vegan through your work, but what success have you had converting people to veganism in your own personal life?
Well, you know, Rob, the approach that I use with people with whom I'm talking personally or students that I'm talking to in class or groups that I'm talking to about animal issues is basically the same approach. I mean, I focus on the concept of moral schizophrenia as I discuss in my book, Introduction to Animal Rights, Your Child is a Dog. I mean, we all agree that it's wrong to inflict unnecessary suffering on animals. I mean, I've never met anybody in the 22 years I've been doing this now. In all of that time, I've never met one person who disagrees with the proposition that it's that it's wrong to inflict unnecessary suffering on animals. Indeed, everybody agrees with that pretty strongly. And the next thing I do is to focus them on the concept of necessity. What does it mean? If we say that it's wrong to inflict unnecessary suffering on animals, what does that mean? I mean, necessity must mean at least that it's wrong to inflict suffering on animals for reasons of pleasure, amusement, or convenience. I mean, obviously, if we had a rule that said it's wrong to inflict unnecessary suffering, but it's okay to do so if it causes you or brings you pleasure, amusement, or convenience, then you'd have an exception that would swallow the rule.
Now, but Gary, is this how you bring it up to people, though?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, absolutely. I mean, someone will say to me, well, you don't eat meat. You know, you're a vegan. I mean, because that's really radical. So you're a vegan. And I say, yeah. And they say, well, that's pretty radical. I say, no, it's not. It's common sense. What do you mean it's common sense? I say, look, do you think it's all right, you know, to inflict suffering on animals? No. I mean, it's absolutely wrong. You know, you got to have a good reason. I said, you think it's wrong to inflict unnecessary suffering on animals? Absolutely. Well, what do you think that means? I mean, you think it's all right to inflict suffering on animals because it brings you pleasure, amusement, or convenience? Absolutely not. Okay, you're sitting there eating meat. Do you need to eat meat to lead an optimally healthy lifestyle? Nobody maintains that you do. Indeed, you can find a lot more mainstream healthcare people who are maintaining every day that eating animals and animal products is bad for you. And every environmental scientist I know believes that animal agriculture is a disaster for the planet. So there's no necessity involved whatsoever. The best justification we have for inflicting pain, suffering, and death on 10 billion animals in the U.S. alone every year for food is that they taste good. We like the taste of their flesh. That's not a good moral story to tell. And so, you know, by the time I'm done with this discussion, which actually takes a very short period of time, I'm not saying the person's going to convert, but the argument that there is any moral justification for this is gone in a second. I mean, you know, sometimes someone will come back and say, yeah, but animals are different from us. They can't reason. They can't think. And I say, well, you know, a lot of people can't reason or think. Is it okay to, you know, to eat them or, you know, put them in circuses, rodeos, or zoos? Or should we make, you know, shoes out of people who can't think or reason or whatever? And, you know, we get by that. But the bottom line is you can very, very quickly get away from the idea that there's any moral justification for it. The person you're talking to or the people you're talking to have to decide whether morality matters, and that's not something, you know, that's not something you can convince somebody of. I mean, either morality is important for somebody or it's not. Most of us like to think of ourselves as moral people, and most of us at least think that we take morality seriously. So I think that, you know, this approach does work. Something else I do, Rob, is if I know someone has non-human companions, I will talk with them about their non-human companions and say, to have them tell me some stories about their dogs or their cats or their whatever. You know, I get them to tell me about how intelligent they are and how emotional they are and how complex they are cognitively. And then I ask them, you know, what do you think the difference is between the animal that you love and the animal that you're sticking a fork into? And that often triggers a very interesting discussion because, you know, most people have never thought about that. And, you know, most people don't realize that, I mean, to the extent that there's a difference, say, between a pig and a dog, a pig is probably smarter than the dog. So if intelligence is what, you know, for me, sentience is all that matters. But if intelligence is important, then, well, you know, the pig wins. You ought to be eating the dog. So, you know, I focus on those sorts of discussions, those sorts of arguments. You know, why do you think that there's a difference between the animal that you love and you regard as a member of your family and the animal that, you know, you're cutting up on the plate? Now, obviously, as a strategic matter, it's oftentimes not the best time to have the discussion when someone's sitting there eating meat because they may feel attacked, and that's not a good thing as a strategic matter.
If there's someone, though, in your life, like maybe a lifelong friend or a family member,
yeah,
who have never brought it up, never even, you know, gave a hint that they were interested in talking about veganism, do you make an effort to bring it up, or do you wait for them?
Well, it differs. I mean, generally, I've not had the experience very much where people don't want to talk about it with me. I have very few relationships, either in terms of family or friends, where people don't want to discuss it with me. I mean, most people know it's a major part of my life. So if we're going to have a discussion about anything that is significant in terms of what I think about, I think everybody knows that's where we're going to go. So, you know, most people tend to raise it with me. I personally don't tend to raise it with people while they're sitting there eating. I'm not often in a situation where I'm sitting eating with people who are consuming meat, although it does happen. I might be at a university function where, you know, obviously they're not serving vegan food. And if I'm sitting there with people who are eating meat, which is, you know, fairly frequent at an event like that, I don't generally tend to bring it up unless they do. I mean, sometimes people who are sitting there eating meat will comment on the fact that I'm eating a salad and we'll get into a discussion. And if they bring it up, that's fine. Or if I'm sitting on an airplane next to somebody who notices that I'm eating a vegan meal while she's eating a, you know, the roast beef option, and she brings it up, I'll talk with her about it. But I generally don't tend to have discussions with people when they're eating meat unless they raise it.
And have the people in your life that you've spoken to just casually about this, have they become vegan or have they started to question their choices?
Some have and some haven't. But, you know, at least the ones who haven't no longer try to justify it. I mean, they have to figure out whether morality means something to them or not. You know, one of the reasons why I keep doing this and persisting in this is that the amount of feedback I get every week from people who have either read one of my books or who have read something on the web or have heard me talk on some show or who have been a student of mine in one of my classes, I get emails constantly from people and letters and sometimes phone calls at my office from people who say, you know, I've never really understood the argument. It's really so simple when you think about it. It doesn't even require a complicated theory of rights or anything like that. I mean, it makes perfect sense and it's common sense and it's clear. And so, I mean, I just got an email yesterday from someone who read Introduction to Animal Rights and said, you know, this book convinced me that I have to become a vegan, and I'm going to become a vegan. And I also, one of the things I do when I talk to animal people is there's a startling number of people who identify themselves as animal rights advocates who are not vegans. They're vegetarians, but they're not vegans. And I simply don't understand that. And one of the points I make in my book and that I make to every animal advocate I speak to who's not a vegan, there is more suffering in a glass of milk than there is in a pound of flesh. I don't think you should eat either of them. But the idea that you're all right if you're eating, you know, if you're not eating meat, but, you know, if you have dairy or you like cheese pizza or, you know, the odd Baskin-Robbins ice cream or whatever, that it's okay. No, I don't agree with that.
Actually, I'm going to ask you one question before we end the interview.
Yeah.
You know, you usually start off the argument with talking about the suffering of animals. Well, what about, you know, all these organic farms that are popping up? And in downtown Toronto, we have something called the Healthy Butcher, kind of an oxymoron, I think. And apparently all their animals are completely free-range, you know, more free-range than what we assume free-range to be. And then they have no qualms about buying meat from those places because they don't suffer, so they say. What do you say to that?
That's nonsense. You know, go to the slaughterhouse where those animals are being slaughtered. Right. First of all, I do not believe. Is it possible to reduce the suffering of animals in terms of moving from a factory farm model to a non-factory model? Can you reduce suffering? The answer is yes, to some degree you can, but there will still be some suffering involved in the raising of the animals, and there is certainly suffering involved in the slaughtering of those animals.
And the transportation.
And the transportation, yeah. And the slaughtering of the animals involved an enormous amount of suffering. And, you know, I think that phenomenon of, you know, the organic meats or the humanely raised meat, because I see this in the health food store that is near my house, the supermarket, where, you know, when I first started shopping there 10 years ago, they didn't sell any meat. Now they sell meat, and they have signs that, you know, that animal groups approve of this, it's humane, it's this, it's that. And I think this is a consequence of the fact that you have large animal organizations that say, well, you know, the issue is being kind, being compassionate. And when you have large organizations praising fast food chains like McDonald's or Burger King's for their supposed improvements in the way that they're slaughtering zillions of animals or raising zillions of animals, whatever, I think this is a consequence of that, is you encourage people to think that they can satisfy their moral obligations to non-humans by purchasing organic free-range meat. I think that's nonsense.
Gary, thanks for being with us and sharing your opinions.
My pleasure. Take care, Rob.
That was Gary Francione. You were listening to Professor of Law at Rutgers University School of Law. Now we're going to be switching over to the UK to talk to Mary Brady and her 9-year-old son, Seamus. And I encourage everyone to visit animalvoices.ca and read Mary's fantastic bio that she sent me. It's a really entertaining and inspirational look into her life. And you'll also get to read about her books that she has written and her variety of activism, including organizing next month's Heart of England Vegan Festival. Mary, welcome to the show.
Hiya.
Now, I contacted you because I was intrigued of everything you had done, but you then told me the most inspiring vegan activist in your life was your son, Seamus. Could you tell us why?
Well, I'm very lucky because I've got two inspiring vegan activists in my life. One of them is Seamus. Before he was able to talk, he was paying attention to anybody, you know, regardless of whether the person was a cat or a pigeon or a human. He's always been a very compassionate child. I remember when he was about 3, he's got to be the only child I've ever looked after who didn't chase the pigeons because he didn't want to scare them. So he's always been quite compassionate and open-minded, and I think most children are that way until they get brainwashed out of it.
Right.
But I actually went vegan when I was expecting Seamus because when my milk came, I was a vegetarian at the time and didn't eat eggs, but when my milk came through, I was suddenly horrified at the thought that I was stealing milk from some other mother's baby. And I'm convinced that was Seamus in the womb.
He was an activist before he was born.
I think so, yeah.
That's excellent. Now, you told me that he got 13 members of his class to boycott meat in his last school. He veganized a Muslim family at that school, the Hindu sweet shop around the corner where 3 generations of them went vegan, and veganized a whole range of sweets, and recently another little boy, and apparently almost his mother. Is Seamus there?
Seamus is there. He's playing with something at the moment.
Okay.
We'll see if he can remember all of those stories, because he takes it for granted that you just talk to everybody you meet about veganism, and he doesn't think it's anything unusual. He just sort of talks to everybody about what's important to him. So shall I put him on to you?
Yes, I'd love to.
Okay,
yeah,
here he is.
Speak with him.
Right. Hello.
Hi, Seamus. How are you?
I'm fine.
Now, I just spoke with your mom about all these people that you've turned vegan, and you've got 13 members of your class to boycott meat in your last school, and you've veganized all these people that you've met. Now, there are so many people, 2, 3, 10 times your age, who can't do that. How do you do it?
I just talk. I think I just talk them out of eating meat.
Do you think it's important to talk to everyone you meet about being vegan?
I suppose that's one good way, I'd say.
And what do you say to people when they ask you why you are vegan?
Well, it's because I just don't like the fact of eating dead animals or drinking milk or something like that.
I've heard that you're known in some circles as a cat whisperer. Can you tell me why?
I do actually talk to cats.
You're pretty good at understanding what they're thinking.
Not particularly, but okay. I'm good at purring and talking cat.
Well, that's excellent, Seamus. I think you're pretty inspiring for the rest of us who, marvel at what a 9-year-old can do. I just want to thank you for all the activism that you're doing.
Oh, it's fine.
Can I talk to your mom again?
Yeah, okay.
Thanks. Take care.
Okay. Hiya.
You've got quite the inspiring son there, Mary.
Yes, he suddenly got a bit nervous because he realized that the show's going out live.
It's going out live, yeah.
He suddenly thought, oh no, people are listening to me in Canada and America.
Well, no, I mean, I think that's great, you know, and the way he says it, it's like it's just common sense.
It is common sense to a child.
I mean,
when you're a child, it just makes sense that you don't steal from other people. It makes sense that you don't kill other people. It makes sense that you just do the right thing. And I remember when the Ethiopian famine was on, I couldn't for the life of me understand why we didn't just let people have the food that they needed. I had people explaining economics and politics, etc., to me, and was persuaded that it wasn't common sense to think that people should be allowed to have the food that they needed. It's come as a bit of a surprise to me since being a mother to realize that children have far more sense than adults. If we listen to the way they run things, the world would be a hell of a lot better.
It's really the truth, honest to gosh. Now, Mary, you've also had a lot of success converting people to veganism. We're going to be brief because we only have a few minutes left.
Yeah.
What is your advice for the best way to go about doing that?
Well, I just talk to people. I mean, this is something I've learned from Seamus, and hopefully Seamus has learned from me. You know, when you're out shopping and you're checking your ingredients, you know, you strike up conversations with people about what you're eating and why. I do a lot of school talks. I went to a school in Dudley last week. Basically, I just cooked them all a pizza, and Redwoods sent us samples to the school, and so they were trying out vegan fish fingers and so on. And while I was chatting to these kids and cooking for them, they couldn't think that I was being dictatorial or nasty or anything. And I've had an email today from a girl looking for a vegan buddy, which I'm really pleased with. And we do free food fairs. You know, we take over a room in a town centre somewhere and basically put on a vegan buffet. Just send people out with sort of little free bits of food and say, do you want to come in and try our fantastic vegan food? And, you know, we get a few hundred people coming in and trying out the food. And then, of course, a lot of them, because we hand out the buddy cards, you know, a lot of them later approach us for a vegan buddy.
Hmm.
But the thing is, basically, it's nothing to be ashamed of being vegan. As you say, it makes perfect sense. It's so easy. I mean, as Gary Francione was just saying, it's so simple.
Mm-hmm.
A child can understand it, and a child can explain it. And I think we should just cheerfully and non-confrontationally talk to people, because a lot of people are ashamed of it, and I've never quite understood why anyone would be ashamed of the word vegan. So I think we just need to be consistent and friendly.
Friendly and cheerful and yeah, optimistic about it all.
I'm optimistic because, I mean, since I've been vegan, which is about 9.5 years now, it's incredible how much more accepting the public has become of the word. You know, I go on the local radio quite a lot. If I get a taxi driver, I've discovered lots of the Asian community in Wolverhampton are vegan and veggie. If I get an Asian taxi driver and he recognises my voice, I've developed a tendency to get free taxis.
Oh, really? Great. And one good way, I think, to keep new vegans vegan is your Vegan Buddies system. Can you tell people about that and how they can get set up with that?
Well, the Vegan Buddies scheme is designed basically to help aspiring vegans, you know, people like I was when I was pregnant with my son, who think, oh, my God, where am I going to get my calcium? Where am I going to get my protein? Or, you know, people who might think, oh, I'm going to miss chocolate or ice cream. So what we've been doing is we've been getting people to email us at realfood.org.uk. And at the moment, we're in the process of setting up a website because we're getting so many people writing in for Vegan Buddies that it's taking a lot more work than it did when we first set it up.
And they can be set up with other vegans, like in the area or through email?
In the area, if they're lucky that way. I mean, for example, I took a woman in Wolverhampton shopping last weekend and stocked her kitchen up full of vegan food. And a couple of days later, I went around and cooked a vegan meal for her and her family. So that kind of thing works very well if you can find a vegan buddy in your neighbourhood. If you can't find a vegan buddy in your neighbourhood, of course, you can just find somebody that you can email and ask specific questions. I think someone in America would do better to have an American buddy.
Right, yeah.
But then again, if I get somebody asking, who like myself is pregnant and thinking of going vegan, I'd want to find them somebody in a similar situation, even if they weren't actually in the same neighborhood or country even.
And for everyone out there, we've got those emails to get in touch with Vegan Buddies on our website, animalvoices.ca. We're almost out of time, but I'd like you to take 30 seconds and talk about raising vegan kids, because I know you like to speak about that, and there are lots of people out there that have heard these child abuse stories about raising their kids vegan. Tell me what you have to say about that.
Well, my son is very tall for his age. He's not actually the tallest kid in the class. There's one lad taller than him, and he's a veggie.
Really?
He's strong and fit and healthy, and in fact he's just run out into the garden and he's jumping up and down a lot, so he's got a wide, varied vegan diet. Now, I read a story about children who've been taken off their parents because they're emaciated and starved, but if you look at what was actually in the house, it wasn't a balanced vegan diet. There were no nuts and seeds, they didn't have any oil in their diet, and it just seems as though these are children who just weren't fed enough. Unfortunately, I can't sort of show everybody a picture of what Seamus looks like, but he's just a very healthy, clever kid.
Yeah, he's adorable. There's a picture of him on the website. If you go under shows and you can read about Mary, you can read her bio, and then I posted her picture there. And there's also a PDF of the Real Food magazine that's dedicated to vegan kids. You can download there as well. Mary, I want to thank you for being with us. I think there's a million things we could talk about, and we'll probably have you back on the show again sometime soon.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mary.
Bye.
You've been listening to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM. We're totally out of time. We'll get back to you next week talking about the dairy industry. Stay tuned for Roadrunner.